On behalf of everyone at WBEZ, thank you to the members who support this station. We are 100% funded by our community, and that's because listeners like you understand the importance of keeping fact-based, independent reporting free and accessible to everyone. Thank you for being an essential part of everything that we do. If you aren't a member yet, we hope you'll join us. Give monthly to keep your news strong at wbez.org/donate.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around because later in the episode, we'll break down today's biggest regional stories. But first, for Women's History Month, we rewind the clock to the 1960s, back to a Chicago when being openly gay could cost you your safety, your job, and even your sense of community. Sound familiar? Well, in the middle of that, activist Vernita Gray got to work. She was fighting for fairness and equal rights for women and the LGBTQ community. Among her efforts, she organized support groups and even started a telephone hotline from her home, while LGBTQ people were faced with great hostility from outside the community. Gray was also one half of Illinois' first same-sex couple to get legally married in the state. So we're looking back at Gray's impact and how her actions still echo today. At the table was Jennifer Breyer, who's a distinguished professor of history and gender and women's studies at UIC. Now, Jennifer pitched us this idea, so I started by asking her why Vernita Gray's story was so compelling to her.
Vernita Gray is such an important person in Chicago history, in LGBTQ history, in Black history. She seemed like the perfect person to bring this month, Women's History Month, and coming back and talking to you again about women's history and just recognizing how incredible the people of Chicago are and how much they have taught us about women's history.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to her early life for folks who aren't familiar with the name. She's a native Chicagoan.
Yep.
First of all, what else should we know? Where'd she go to school?
She grew up in North Lawndale, which is important to know. She's from the West Side, even though she spends most of her adult life between the South and the North Side. She was in high school when Dr. King came to North Lawndale, and that was one of the things that mobilized her in thinking about civil rights. She was a alum of Columbia College. And in 1969, she didn't go to Stonewall. She went to Woodstock and came back from Woodstock and had learned about Stonewall and was really off to the races.
And got inspired, didn't
yeah.
she? Yeah, tell us more.
Yeah. She decided to, she was sort of like, I get the sense, I met her when she was alive. I had the chance to know her some when I was first in Chicago. And so I have this sense of this incredible personality, like this person who just knew everyone, mm-hmm. always knew what was going on, was always the person that you were going to call if you were in trouble or if something was going wrong.
And from what I read, had a sense of humor that was pretty infectious.
Yeah, she was a piece of work. She immediately starts organizing in women's liberation and in gay and lesbian liberation. And she lives at that time in Hyde Park. By 1970, she's mm-hmm. an organizer of one of the first Pride March in Chicago, which is 1 year after Stonewall in 69. She is active in all sorts of things. She forms something called the Women's Caucus of the Chicago Gay Alliance, which later becomes Chicago Lesbian Liberation. Mm-hmm. She's a founding member of the Collective of Lavender Women, which is one of the most important newspapers, just to date ourselves, one of the most important newspapers of gay and lesbian liberation of the 1970s is published here in mm-hmm. Chicago, and she's a member of it.
She established an LGBTQ support line.
Yep, out of her house.
Out of her house.
Yep.
And, she wasn't just active here in Chicago, right? She also was doing some things at the White House.
That's later. Before she even it's a long road to the White House, and there is a biography of Vernita that has the subtitle From Woodstock to the White House, written by Tracy Baim, our colleague at who's now at the Chicago Community Trust, and Owen Keenan. But I guess I would say that she does like to party also. So there's definitely a sense, and I think that this might make sense to people, like it wasn't all politics. It was also fun and partying and dancing and joy and movement. And that, and why Vernita matters to that is that she's really like, you can hear her describe going to dances, sometimes at Circle Campus, sometimes at the University of Chicago, even though she wasn't a student there. She was part of something called the Monday Night Meeting, which was, at least initially, a multiracial gathering of women of color and white women. Mm-hmm. And she liked going to bars. She liked going out and partying. And she also was someone who told us about how racial segregation manifested itself in Chicago.
Meanwhile, what is the atmosphere like in Chicago for a black gay woman at the time? Like, was there the room to have this kind of fun?
There
or
were
was
some,
she kind of creating that lane?
A little bit of both. There were some interracial bars, and there were plenty of white bars that, you know, were completely exclusionary to black people. So Vernita and other people would say, like, you had to go with three forms of identification to get into some bars on the North Side, which made them completely unacceptable places for organizing. But there is also a long tradition of bars on the South Side, and there are also house parties that black lesbians create. Pat McCombs, who's still alive, is one of the people who does that. There's a kind of slew of black lesbian activists in Chicago, and Vernita is one of the most important people in it. And so she is navigating a world of the 1970s where there are still regular raids of bars. There's still, obviously, the kinds of effects of knowing that Chicago is one of the most racially segregated places in the country. Mm-hmm. That manifests itself in the gay scene as well. She is part of lesbian and feminist organizing as well. So she's really, she finds herself in lots of different places. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is part of how you, I don't think anyone could have imagined her going to the White House. I don't think anyone could have imagined she would be the first, and her then partner, Pat, would be the first couple married in the state of Illinois in 2013.
Yes, the first same-sex couple in November 27th.
Right before she passed.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were right when you said a few moments ago, there was a lot that Vernita did on that journey to Washington.
Unbelievably so. And always, you know, always prepared to meet the moment, always prepared to have joy and a smile, and also like a fierceness mm-hmm. that very few people, I think, would have wanted to be on the wrong side of.
Tell me, if we didn't have a Vernita back then, what would the movement look like right now? What do you think?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, because in a lot of ways, part of what we understand and we learn from people like Vernita and her contemporaries, Jackie Anderson, who was a philosopher, Pat McCombs also, is, and a range of other women in Chicago and Latinas and white women, all sorts of people, that the struggle for gay and lesbian and trans liberation is not just about gender or sexuality. It's about these larger struggles for racial equality as well. And I don't know that that was always such a comfortable relationship. Yeah. And so part of what happens in Chicago, unlike in other places, or is that we have leaders of our movements who represent a kind of racial and class diversity that it doesn't happen in other places.
Is there still strong lesbian organizing in Chicago?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, it's Women's History Month, and so I always like to think about what the sort of legacies are. There are a lot of legacies that run through this town that are about the history of lesbians of color organizing. So I think about the reality that our Dyke March, which used to be in Andersonville and sort of run counter to the Gay Pride March,
right,
Vernita Gray started a sort of precursor to that, which was that Black lesbians typically went and hung out at the Belmont Rocks and didn't go to the Pride Parade at some point because it was racially exclusionary and they didn't feel welcome there. Then the Dyke March, which had been in this largely white neighborhood, at some point in the early 2000s, organizers, many of them who come from UIC where I teach, figured out that they wanted to have the Dyke March be in different neighborhoods. The Dyke March has been on a bit of hiatus, but it is coming back, and word is that it's going to, again, be outside of the north side of Chicago. And so to really think about how the legacy of racial segregation matters. And someone like Vernita gives us a path.
Yeah.
She gives us something to look to.
She gives activists today something to learn from.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've mentioned this, you know, we're sitting right in the middle of Women's History Month. We just wrapped up Black History Month. Black gay women, as we know, they're often overlooked during these moments, right? Let's be honest, Jennifer. So, yep. So why do you think that is? Why are stories like theirs and their voices often forgotten?
Yeah.
And how do we work to ensure that we preserve them?
Yeah. It's such a great question, and it's both easy to answer and incredibly difficult to answer. The easy answers are the ones that we could imagine pretty quickly, that homophobia, lesbophobia functions in certain ways, racism in certain ways. But the one thing that I do know is that Black lesbians have been at the forefront of most movements for social change that we today think of as perhaps only related to Black women, mm-hmm. right, separating them, or related to LGBT life. So I'm thinking about work on thinking through lesbian health and women's health more generally. So Vernita is at the table, as are many of these women, particularly because Vernita dies of breast cancer, but survives with breast cancer for a long time, of the Lesbian Community Cancer Project. Vernita is around for the founding of Affinity Community Services, which is one of the most important remain, and it still to this day exists, starts in 1995, of Black lesbians, Black bisexual women. It's a sort of gender expansive space.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, bars are an important place as well. And I'm thinking about Nobody's Darling, which is up on the north side now, owned
yes.
Operated by Black lesbians. I think it's really this question. And then I was also thinking about the Combahee River Collective, which is a feminist organization from the 1970s that has some of the most biting and politically savvy analysis of what liberation means. And many of those women are Black lesbians also. Mm-hmm. So they are really at the forefront of arguing that the people who are most impacted by something need to be at the center of the organizing. They're the people who are arguing that if we get taken care of, everyone will get taken care of.
Yeah.
And so I think that is really why they are both left out and should really be our North Star.
But a name for us to remember is certainly Vernita Gray. Jennifer Breyer's Distinguished Professor of History and Gender and Women's Studies at UIC. Thank you once again.
Thanks so much.
Time now for a look at the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. From all the money spent on candidates in the primary election, to the beautiful artwork inside the forthcoming Obama Presidential Library, to a new deal for WNBA players. At the table was Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, Cassie Walker-Burke, our senior editor of arts and culture, and Summer Van Benton, a reporter in our newsroom. Now we're still coming up for air from all the election buzz, so that's where the conversation begins.
My head's still turning from side to side. I mean, there was so much going on, and we were nonstop in this newsroom.
We were nonstop. I mean, I feel like I'm still recovering, and I didn't even host the election night show. So Mary and Pat, I don't know how they're doing it, but they're still coming up at 10 o'clock, and they're still bringing you the news of the day. But are you coming up for air, Summer?
I am. You I got some there. Rest. I did.
But it's always fun to cover the you know, some of those parties and just the temperature.
The energy.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
How about you, Cassie?
Yeah, you know, we've had a busy week with a lot of lineup announcements on the arts desk. Mm-hmm. So we've been busy in a different way. But yeah, it has been a whirlwind week.
It has. All right. So let's talk, Claire, about a major feature of this primary, which was just the sheer amount of money that was spent. WBEZ and the Sun-Times have done extensive reporting on the role of special interest money in Illinois races. And someone who's not happy with those special interest groups, yep, that's Governor Pritzker.
That is correct. Pritzker is condemning the amount of special interest money, but also some of the groups that were providing this money, most notably from a pro-Israel political group that he himself even once supported. So Pritzker, as we know, is Jewish. We also know that he shelled out $5 million, I believe, of his own cashish to Stanton's campaign. But he was also once a donor to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee before he walked away from that organization more than a decade ago. But he told the Associated Press that AIPAC lost its way as a bipartisan group focused on the Middle East.
Yeah. One of those races impacted, Summer, was the 8th Congressional District, which you followed closely. What did that PAC funding look like in that race?
Yeah, it was quite interesting. So there were at least five PACs related to the PAC that tried to influence five congressional races, and the two that saw victories were Donna Miller and the one that I covered, Melissa Bean in the 8th Congressional District. Bean was backed by the most super PAC money of any congressional candidate in the state, which totaled out to about $7 million in super PAC funding. Quite a bit of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
It was making national news yesterday. I mean, NPR was asking Mariah Wolfel, is this in line? And she was like, no, this is way more money than we've
seen.
We
have not seen this before. Yeah. A lot of people testify in Capitol Hill, Claire, you know, military personnel, politicians. But this week, it was a Chicago teacher that testified. What was this about?
This is a CPS teacher that testified essentially about the impact and the effects of President Trump's massive deportation campaign on kids.
What did she say about the kids in her classroom?
So this is first grade teacher Maria Hevner. She works at Funston Elementary in Logan Square. And she basically just said that her kids are still showing signs of anxiety after Operation Midway Blitz. She said that her students were distraught after federal agents threw tear gas, which was near the school. There was an incident in October.
Wow.
And that weeks later, one of her kids even had a panic attack. So still, she's, you know, just making a case for the impact of Operation Midway Blitz to remain top of mind for lawmakers, especially with that funding for the Department of Homeland Security still in limbo.
You know, this is so real. I think back to, you know, when we were in the height of Operation Midway Blitz, my daughter would be texting me from her high school on the north side and saying, oh, mommy, they're at the park that's, you know, adjacent to our school, and some kids are hiding in the cafeteria right now and they don't want to come outside. And it was just, it was crazy. I mean,
my kids are younger, and they were on the playground pretending they were showing each other what to do when the agents would, like, quote unquote, come to the school, and they were playing hide and go seek. They were hiding their friends.
Wow.
And I live in West Ridge, which was a neighborhood that saw a lot of enforcement activity.
Mm-hmm.
And this was on the minds of every single child in the neighborhood.
It really was. Yeah. Oh, boy. Now, recently, Cassie, we've been getting more and more information about the Obama Presidential Library. Everyone's excited about the opening in June. We were learning about what the grounds will look like and that whole Juneteenth celebration. But you've got information on what folks can expect to see inside the building.
We do. This is an extraordinary departure.
I mean, I can't wait to set foot inside that
this
place.
This is incredible. So really, the Obamas have set the stage. They've said this is not a presidential library. This is a center, and it's going to act as such. So there is going to be a fine dining restaurant, athletic facilities, a community hub. But it's also going to be a contemporary art center. And I don't think until our reporting this week that we've really understood the full magnitude of what is planned there. Mm. A curator named Virginia Shore, who has an incredible background, just an incredible resume, has helped commission works from 26 artists. I mean, we are talking about in the millions here. They won't give us a price tag, but in the millions here. And some of the artists are names that we know locally and are proud of locally. So that's, you know, Nick Cave, the Astor Gates, Richard Hunt, the sculptor who died in 2023. But there are also some big contemporary players. You have Julie Meritu, who has an 83-foot stained glass window that is on the north facade of the center. That's one of the first pieces they announced. Kiki Smith, Jenny Holzer, who is a name that people know because of her big LED light art. Yes. So we have some major commissions that are coming to the center, and there's going to be a gallery in the middle of it.
And again, when can I get my ticket to get inside? Is there a gala that's going to be happening here?
I think there'll be a lot of events. I think there's be a big public event.
This is so exciting. And it really sets this center apart from the other presidential libraries across the country.
There is no parallel.
There's nothing like
for
this.
I think there's one that has maybe a big mural, but there's really nothing that is anything like this. And when you think about Chicago's contemporary art prominence and how sometimes we are still a bit of a flyover city in that scene, despite our incredible artists that are here, what this does to really reclaim that moniker for our city, I think is going to be very interesting to see.
Claire, spring break. It's coming. It's here.
It's here.
Travelers are headed all over the place or will be heading to O'Hare and Midway specifically. Yes. What's the travel forecast between now and the end of March?
I feel like this has sort of crept up on people. I have a friend who was thinking of coming out next weekend, and she looked at flights. And
they're crazy.
They're insane right now. I mean, as we know, the price of fuel is up. That includes fuel for cars as well as jets, so that's a factor. But people are certainly traveling. Spring officially starts tomorrow, but the Department of Aviation expecting nearly 4 million passengers between O'Hare and Midway starting today through Monday, March 30th.
So and let's remember these TSA agents.
There are going to be lines.
Working without pay right now. The lineups
yesterday
are insane.
We were reporting people were waiting hours just to get into O'Hare, into the airport physically.
Oh.
So this is going to take some time if you're traveling. And also there's going to be more of you there. So you're contending with that. It's going to be kind of competitive. O'Hare anticipating a 13% increase in passengers compared to last year, which is quite a bump.
Wow. Let's talk Chicago Humanities Fest, Cassie, because we got the lineup this week. Remind us who the folks are.
We did get the lineup this week, and the Chicago Humanities Fest really takes, you know, high-profile names from across all kinds of disciplines. So you have Padma Lakshmi, who has this new America's Culinary Cup show. It's the highest price tag for any food cooking competition ever.
It's kind of a good show. It's kind of
entertaining. She's coming. She's going to be talking. There's two local chefs in that mix. So she's coming. Veronica Roth. You know, I'm focused on some of the local names. Veronica Roth, who, of course, is the author of Divergent, is going to be speaking. There are plenty of political talks. David Axelrod, the political strategist, who, of course, was, you know, part of the Obama campaign and has continued to be a voice in politics. Mm-hmm. So lots of names, and they're all over the city. There's even four neighborhood events this year, which are pretty cool. So taking the festival to the neighborhoods, the events are ticketed, and they're talks, and generally, you know, you can ask questions. It's a nice way to kind of turn your brain back on.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Let's talk sports, Summer.
Yes.
Yeah, I know you pay close attention to the WNBA.
Yes.
And the league has finally reached a deal with its players. How big of a deal is this?
It's extremely huge. If you know anything about the W, you know that the players have been fighting for pay and for their equal treatment and just respectable treatment for years. So to hear that they have reached an agreement with the league is extremely huge. Our colleagues at the Sun-Times have reported that more than 100 hours of negotiations went into getting this deal together. Now, though the league has not announced the details of this agreement, mm-hmm. It's reported that salary cap will rise to about $7 million. That's up from $1.5 million. And when you think about these players who are putting their bodies on the line for mm-hmm. entertainment, who are making the league so much money, and the exponential growth the league has seen, this is a huge win for players, for fans who have been advocating. Mm-hmm. This is huge, and yeah. I'm super excited.
I mean, I remember doing reporting back in the day in D.C. about this and just the sheer number of WNBA players who were still living at home.
Yeah.
And it was just juxtaposing their lives with NBA players. It was just a drastic
or forced to play overseas in the off season, so they basically don't get a break.
Yeah, and we've seen the emergence of Unrivaled, which has been a huge win. Mm-hmm. I think multiple forces have gone into the league finally caving and making this deal.
Yeah. What does this mean for the Chicago Sky?
Yeah.
We're going into a new season.
We're going into a new season. Luckily, they were able to make this deal when they were so that the season won't be pushed back. But the Sky will be able to retain some more players. I know it's always a conversation of, you know, what players are staying or leaving. But with this new agreement, we might see some, you know, continue to stay with the Sky. And the first game is on May 9th against the Portland Fire. So it's good to know that, you know, they were able to come to the Steel. We will be locked and loaded for the season to start in early May.
Yeah,
and
right around the corner.
Right around the corner. And WNBA All-Star Weekend is this year in Chicago.
Yes.
Which is super excited. And nice. I've been tracking fans online. They're like, okay, great. Now that the players have their money, we can turn up and have fun the way we're supposed to.
More reason to celebrate.
Yeah. This is great.
Well, let's keep talking sports here, Claire, and shift to the Bears because they're bringing back a fan favorite.
Yeah, Chicago loves hometown players, and that's exactly what's happening. This is a linebacker, Jack Sanborn. They signed him on a one-year deal. He's a I don't know if he says his name like that, but that's how I imagine.
I hear the Chicago
He's
in there.
A Lake Zurich native. He actually signed with the Bears back in 2022, was with the team for three seasons. He spent last year with the Cowboys. He was injured. Now we're bringing him back for another year. We'll see how it goes.
Awesome. Any other stories you're following?
It's sports related.
I'm shocked.
But opening day for the Cubs is next Thursday, and Cubs fans kind of celebrating a win of one of their own. This was this week when Venezuela beat Team USA in the World Baseball Championship, but it was Daniel Palencia who was pitching for Venezuela, who is a Cub, one of our closers who actually pitched for the last out of that game. So
nice.
People are excited. He's bringing some good energy, potentially might even be playing opening day at Wrigley.
All right. Well, real quick, let's find out what you two are watching as well. I know, Summer, you're all Lala all the time.
I am. I'm really excited about Lala because I love anything culture, community. And I know we talked about it yesterday. We have headliners like Lord and Charlie XCX, but the lineup seems like pretty narrow. I know I'm excited for Olivia Dean and Leon Thomas,
yes.
But zooming out, there's a broader conversation happening that I'm tracking. Particularly about audiences not really gravitating or resonating with the lineups, especially in the most recent years. And I think this lineup is another example of that.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's kind of been more of the same. I've been keeping an eye over the last two or three years just because my kids have been super interested in going. But yeah, it's kind of the same.
Yeah,
same.
Pretty
yeah.
same.
I'm glad
strong feelings out there on the TikTok.
And I'm glad you're following that, Summer. And what's on your arts radar, Cassie?
Can I tell you two things really quickly that are exciting? Tomorrow, the new album drops from Hooray for the Riff Raff. Now, Hooray for the Riff Raff, you think about New Orleans. You think about this musician who traveled on trains and just was, you know, unhoused for a while. And this incredible singer-songwriter who has moved to Chicago. And they've put together a band of Chicago musicians. They've recorded an album live at the Old Town School of Folk Music. And it comes out tomorrow, which is incredible. Talking about everything from immigration enforcement to a relationship with their father. And I think it's going to be an incredible album. We have a story up today from our reporter, Courtney Kippers. The second thing, there's a choir named Consonance here that is performing a piece this weekend in celebration of Women's History Month. It's Women's History Month.
Yes.
And the piece incorporates the voices of 47 women across history, including the suffragettes who helped secure our voting rights.
Wow.
And so this piece is a very powerful piece. It includes projections, history, and so it'll be this weekend twice in Forest Park.
Looking forward to that as well.
Need to check that out.
WBEZ's Cassie Walker-Burke, Summer Van Benton, and Claire Lane.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yason. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. If you like what you heard, we hope you'll join us for more. We drop a new episode about Chicago news and culture every weekday afternoon, including our weekly news recap on Fridays, and once a month, Ask the Mayor. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.